Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast Squawk Stick Thargo Everywhere. I am Molchar, the publicity droid for 2000 AD. And this week on the official 2000 AD podcast, we are going to be talking about a invisible art to comics. Well, it's certainly one that a lot of people don't really pay any heed, and that's just the way the people who put it on the page like it. We are, of course, talking about letterers, the unsung heroes that make comics readable. They put the words on the page. They make sure that the bubbles don't obscure the wonderful artwork. And so today we're going to be talking to Annie Parkhouse, who is one of our longest standing lettering droids, and also Simon Boland, who's one of our newest lettering droids. And they're going to be talking about the art of lettering 2000 AD. And I know for one that I'm really looking forward to finding out a little bit more about the one job that nobody really notices on the page. Now, don't forget that it's Christmas coming up soon, and so that means a bumper end-of-year prog from 2000 AD. Prog 1961 is out on the 16th of December. If you pick this up in newsagents or you're a subscriber, then you're going to be treated to a fantastic Ian Kennedy wraparound cover. This is brand new art from a veteran many, many years standing, and it's fantastic. The response to the cover has been amazing online, so you lucky. Lucky Earthlets. If you buy your 2000 AD through a UK comic book store, then you will be getting a special Diamond exclusive variant by Simon Bisley. That's only available through UK comic book stores. So depending on which one you want, or if you want both, you know where to get them. And that's a 100-page extravaganza of new strips. It's the perfect place to start reading 2000 AD, whether you're somebody who's never read it before or whether you're a lapsed reader. Jump on board with the galaxy's greatest comic this Christmas and give yourself a bit of a stocking filler. I also want to give mention to a web series that we have running at the moment. If you've not been to the 2000 AD YouTube channel, then go to youtube.com/2000AD online, where you'll find not only videos of our droids, but also the 2000 AD ABC, which is a series that we started a few weeks ago, which is made up of bite-sized videos going through alphabetically the greatest stories from the galaxy's greatest comic. We kicked off with the ABC Warriors 7 weeks ago, or is it 8? 7 or 8, and we're making our way through the alphabet. So we've already touched on the ABC Warriors. We've taken a look at Judge Anderson. Last week was Aquila, the series by Gordon Rennie and Lee Gallagher and Patrick Goddard. And this week it's Ampney Crucius Investigates by Ian Edgington and Simon Davis. Each video sums up each story in a nutshell, and it's perfect if you want to get some backstory on 2000 AD, and also if you want to discover some of the lesser known characters from the past almost 39 years. So make sure that you go to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/2000AD online and check out the 2000 AD ABC. And that leads me nicely into another recommendation to sign up to the 2000 AD Thrill Mail. You'll get notifications of all the new stuff that's coming out from 2000 AD, both online and in print. If you go to 2000ADonline.com/thrillmail, 2000ADonline.com/thrillmail, and you'll get a weekly Thrillgasm direct into your inbox with free comics, competitions, all the latest news, all the stuff about merchandise, and a little glimpse into some classic covers from on this day. Whether you read your 2000 AD in the weekly progs or you pick up our graphic novels, there's one thing that everybody who reads them not only engages with, but also doesn't necessarily notice is there, which is the speech bubbles. It may sound odd to refer to things so obvious on the page as being invisible, but I speak for myself, and I'm sure I speak for many other people, that we devour the script that's in those speech bubbles, but we don't necessarily pay much heed or mind to how they're placed on the page. And the art of the comic book letterer is one that is not easy, as I'm sure we've seen in some lesser examples. So in this episode, I wanted to get an idea from two of our lettering boys, just what goes into making sure that the galaxy's greatest comic is the most readable comic in the galaxy. So it's an absolute pleasure to welcome a lettering droid of many, many, many years standing, Annie Parkhouse. Welcome to the Thrillcast, Annie.
Hi.
So you've been lettering comics for a number of years, going all the way back to the days of Lion back at IPC, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, I was on the production staff at that point and had to step in on a lettering job and kind of got stuck.
that's you pretty much stuck firmly then, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Embedded.
So you're on the production staff. What kind of things were you doing at the time? Because the way that magazines and comics were put together back then, very different to how they are now, isn't it?
Very different, yes. I mean, we used to get a lot of work from the Spanish and Argentinian artists, and I think they used to work on a sort of factory system. So if the guy that drew faces was off sick that week, the artwork would arrive, you know, without any visages. So you had to be a little bit deft with pen and brush and, you know, fill in the missing bits, so to speak.
Wow.
Also, a lot of resizing. You know, when you were doing things for annuals, you had to resize the boards, which meant absolutely massacring them in some cases, sticking them back together again. that sort of thing. Title design. But, of course, at IPC we had a studio, very good studio. So although you would design them, it was always be the studio who would make them up into the finished item. Mm. And a lot of reprints. I remember the first job I did was actually Dandare, and it was where they used to bleach out from the comic themselves, so you got a very loose black and white image that you would, you know, from the colour plate, that you would then have to do a lot of cross hatching to sort of bring it into black and white. So, and that was the first job I did, and I was shaking so much, it was just awful.
so they would literally bleach out the colour from...
That's right.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible.
So you'd get a really bad bromide print that you'd then have to work on, yeah.
Wow.
So you sit with a manual in front of you and go, oh yeah, that's supposed to be that colour, and you'd cross-hatch it and stuff.
Wow. that's incredible, just the sheer... physicality of that, you know, it's not pushing things around on the screen. It's physically repurposing and, as you say, cutting up and sticking back together. That it's wonderfully, obviously, old school, but also the range of skills you must have had to have back then.
Yeah, and of course I started with none.
Right.
So, yes, you spent all your time dipping into black ink, white, graphic white, an awful lot of graphic white. Mm. You know, you got very deft with tape and stuff like that, and Letraset, you know,
yeah.
Peeling Letraset out of your underwear every night. Oh, I mean, it was hell.
You've already mentioned about the kind of structure of a big publishing company like that,
yeah.
IPC, where you have a specific design department. I'm curious what that kind of office environment was like back then, particularly for somebody who's come into it with no skills and is kind of working their way up from the bottom.
It was quite anarchic, really.
Mm.
I mean, I could list the staff I was working with, and it was a bit like the who's who of British comics now, so looking back. But yes, I just like disadvantage because I was in the boys' juveniles, and there were no other girls, really, apart from, there was Jan Shepherd, of course, and Gina Hart, the colourist. But on the actual production side, there weren't that many women. So the editor I was given didn't really... trust me at all when I arrived, you know.
Mm.
But we got on really well after that. Yeah. As long as I made deadline, it didn't matter.
Ah, well, that's the credo of every editor, really, isn't it? Get it in on time, and
he was an absolute gem, because if I had a terrible hangover and I phoned up, I just had to say, look, I'm sorry, I can't come in. I had a really rough night last night, and he'll just say, get down the pub, get another drink, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Oh, what halcyon days!
Oh yes, I hope John Saunders isn't listening to this. Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, you mentioned there about you know, some of the names that you work with. What are the ones that, what are the kind of personalities that stand out from back then?
Oh no, I can't. No.
No. Oh, okay.
I don't want to be sued. No. Who did I work with? Well, I mean, Jan Shepherd, of course.
Yeah.
With her connection with Judge Dredd is a well-known name now.
Absolutely.
I worked with Des Skin.
Oh, yes, yeah.
He was in the next office on Buster, and, I mean, Steve Parkas was on Whizzer and Chips up the corridor, and, yes, John Burns, yes.
Right, excellent. Well, these are all names that
Chris Loader.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And so where were the IPC offices at that point?
In Farringdon Street.
Farringdon Street in London. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it was just before they moved to King's Reach.
Mm.
I'd gone freelance by then.
Okay. Is there anything that you miss about those early days of paste up and hand doing things, as it were?
Well, I did carry on doing that. At one point, Steve was rewriting, and I was doing a lot of cutting and sticking on three of the Marvel UK comics at the time. That was in the 80s. That was a bit of a nightmare, because I also had a full-time job. So I'd come home, start work at 7, finish about 2 in the morning, then have to get up again at 6 to get it on the train. I only managed that for about 18 months before I collapsed.
Right.
But yeah, so I was still doing plenty of production work at that point, but that was the last time. As far as on the lettering side, I really miss seeing the artwork.
Mm.
You know, that was always a treat. It's not the same when you get a 72 DPI.
Well, it's always amazing to see that old artwork, that this stuff was literally pasted onto the artwork. Because, I mean, I have a page of David Roach's Joe Janderson on my wall. And, you know, the credit box and the speech bubbles and the captions and everything are physically attached to that artwork. I think with the way that modern comics are produced, you know, the art, if it's sold, is just its own artifact. You know, it's not got anything on top. But there's something wonderfully, tactile about seeing all these layers layered on top of a piece of art.
Is it covered in art cell? Is it lettered on art cell?
No. The stuff is literally pasted on top.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of it was like that. So, I mean, thinking back, you were taking quite a risk with it.
Yeah.
And then it, when they changed the process, they needed a separate black film for the lettering. So then we were lettering on acetate over the top, which, of course, is what collectors love now. You know, that they got artwork that didn't have any lettering on.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that always surprised me was, I mean, you've already touched on it with stuff at IPC, was that people weren't just really letterers. They, they lent a hand to the whole production process. I think that there were people who were letterers who were also doing spot colours on double page spreads on Judge Dredd and things like that.
Yeah, we had to do a certain amount of colouring and also doing colour separations for the printers. And I mean, originally it was still hot metal.
Hmm.
So you're phoning up the printer and saying, do you think you could just chip out a bit of that, and if there were any mistakes made, you know. Obviously that's all got far simpler now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how long were you at IPC for?
It seemed like forever, but in fact it was 2 years. I think I started Just over 2 years. And then the pressure of my freelance work was such that I had to leave. I mean, I just wasn't functioning, doing a full-time and freelance. I mean, work just absolutely exploded.
Right.
So, and I won't say I never looked back, because after I moved up to Carlisle, I was pretty well unemployed for about 2 years. I was at art school, and I was hoping that my lettering work would see me through art school, but it didn't. Things got really, really difficult.
Right.
And then, of course, it all took off again, and that's when all the resizing work and that sort of thing came in.
Right. Right. Okay. So the full time day job and the freelance. The full time was at IPC, and the freelance was that lettering stuff, was that production stuff, or?
Well, I was at art school.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes, I started out full-time at IPC and doing freelance. Then I went freelance for a while, moved back to Carlisle, went to art school, was doing some freelance, and then I started teaching at the art school.
Right.
So the lettering has been a constant theme all the way through, but I've usually done something else, because I mean, I really think over the decades, I would have gone crazy if I'd done nothing but lettering. You laugh. So, yes, I've done lots of different things, worked in bookshops. I work as an architectural librarian. I did alternative therapies. The longest thing I did was teaching ceramics at the art school.
Oh, wow. Okay. And over time, over the decades that you've been doing this, is it something that has got to the point now where, because of the technological changes, you kind of is the kind of thing you can do in your sleep, or is it still something that's very involved that you still take a lot of care over?
Oh, I still take even more care, really,
right?
Because I mean, it used to be with the pressure of deadlines, you really just had to get the damn stuff off to the post, you know. Now you've got a little bit more time, because you know you can send any time, but I find that you get more and more into noodling pixel by pixel, which wasn't the case when you hand lettering. You just slammed it down, and you know it had to be in the right place first time. Whereas now I think, oh no, I think if I take that apart, put it back together, oh no, that looks much better. So yes, I'm taking infinite more care.
Right, right. And have you seen how your work has evolved? Because I letterers have the same kind of styles and tics and everything that artists and writers do. What's the Annie Parkhouse style? What does that involve?
I think as time's gone, I think placement is my thing. I mean, to a neurotic extent. and also, I'll do something and I think, now why haven't I been doing that for years? I mean, things like the thickness of the tail. I don't have a universal tail. I've discovered the perspective you can do with having a thicker tail or a very thin tail. It makes a difference. You know, just little subtleties, which your average punter probably won't notice, but I suddenly think, oh, no, that works. Maybe I'm just going crazy, you know, and no one's told me yet.
So all those years hunched over artwork and a computer slowly sends you mad. But when did you make the transition to digital?
I can't remember precisely, but it must have been about the mid-90s.
Right, okay.
Very, very reluctantly. I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me to go from a craft, as I saw it, you know, a hands-on craft. Because, I mean, with being a potter as well, I'm used to doing things with my hands. So the idea of being a typist just didn't appeal to me at all. Yeah, it was, well, who were you then in 96?
We were Fleetway.
You're Fleetway.
I think. Oh God!
I've gone through Maxwell. I've gone through. I had to start on. I had to go digital, and I, at large expense, bought Illustrator. So I was using Illustrator, and then we were asked to use Quark.
Yeah.
And of course, now it's InDesign that I tend to use most of the time.
Mm. And what kind of impact did that have on the way that you lettered pages? So obviously, we've already mentioned the kind of the fact that you can make tiny changes. But did you take to it well, or was there a period of struggle where you tried to marry up what you knew with what you were discovering?
It was just battling with the technology. When you press buttons and things didn't do what you wanted them to do. And, you know, I mean, a lot of that's got ironed out, hopefully.
Yeah.
But if it hadn't been for Steve, I probably wouldn't have done it at all. I mean, he embraced it not particularly easily, but with a greater fluency than I did. And so he kind of made me a manual, and I stuck with that.
Right. Because it's interesting. My work background is in newspapers, and the number of stories that the more experienced journalists had about when they went from hot type to computers were quite often hilarious. You know, people practically picking these things up and throwing them out the window because they were so frustrated. You know, they'd done things their way for so long, and all of a sudden they were having to learn a completely new skill.
Yes, and I'm still not all that deft. I mean, I still sometimes just say, oh, for heaven's sake, give me a scalpel, you know. to work on the artwork, I haven't taken to my wrists or anything.
I mean, what are the biggest kind of no-nos that in lettering? You know, you see a lot of comic books now, and the lettering doesn't look quite right. What are the key rules that you've learnt over the years?
I don't know about key rules. I hate things that cross over. I mean, not just cross tails, but if you've got a line of action and you're forced into a position where the tail has to cut across it.
Mm.
I mean, say a sword action or something like that.
Yeah.
By putting the tail in the wrong place, you can kill the action dead.
Mm.
Having people talking to each other with a balloon in front of them, you know, like they're talking into an airbag or something.
Mm.
I hate that. I hate seeing that. So it's placement that I'm most neurotic about.
Sure. It was interesting at the Thought Bubble convention the other weekend. We had a portfolio session, and the one thing that really stood out when we were looking at stuff was people not thinking about where the lettering is going to go, and you know, it covering faces and parts of the background. And
yeah, that wasn't a problem so much when working on boards, because people understood much better that the top third of any frame is left for the lettering, if there is lettering, of course. But artists, I think they draw and then they think, oh, that looks a bit blank. Oh, I think I'll put that up, and I'll put a figure up there. And before you know it, the whole frame is filled, and you're lettering around somebody's knees. So please, can I have the top third?
are there particular artists that you really love working with that sort of it's a pleasure to put letters on their pages?
I
realize I'm asking you to pick favorites there.
yes, there's favorites. I suppose. Well, I mean, working with Clint Langley has been interesting,
right?
because we did have some conflicts of space to start off with,
yeah.
But because of the way he works, you know, we could move things around.
Mm.
I loved working on Dante, and I mean that was 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was always a joy. No, I enjoy most of them, really.
Mm.
Yes. I mean, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I hit a glitch, you might hear a wail of horror. Where I say, oh, Mike, why have you done that? You know, or something. But
let's move on to the process of actually lettering a page. When the page comes in, what do you do? Do you read the script first so you've got a good idea of the story? Do you take a look at the artwork? Do you do it page by page?
First of all, I tend to go right through the script, and I strip it out and mark it with a pen.
All right.
A hard copy.
Right.
What I want to do with it. And then I cut and paste the from the script into text boxes.
Mm.
It took me a long time to learn how to do that. I was still typing it until about 10 years ago. Cut and paste it, then I go through and make all the modifications of size, bulbs, etc. Then put the balloons on and away we go. Yeah.
Right, okay. How long does it normally take you to do, say, a five page strip?
It probably takes me about a day. I can do six pages.
Oh, wow, yeah, okay.
That's very, very slow.
Right, all right.
You know, I hear of letters these days that can do like 100 pages in 3 days, and I think
wow.
They must have a different technique to me.
Mm. Mm.
So, yeah, I feel a bit like an old-fashioned lady doing it that way. Yeah, in fact, it doesn't save me any time using a computer, because I used to do 60 pages a week in hand lettering.
Wow.
And I'd be quite pushed to do that now on computer.
Mm. Okay.
But if anyone wants to tell me how to do it faster, I'd welcome any suggestion.
And has there been, okay, I mean, you mentioned Clint Langley. I was thinking about, is there much of a, where does the letter sit in the relationship between the artist and the writer and the reader? Because you're communicating information which is imperative to the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of the lost, the forgotten art almost, that people kind of take it for granted that there's going to be bubbles on the page and captions, and they read them quite merrily without really understanding the mechanics involved.
Well, I don't see any reason why they should know the mechanics involved. Mm. I think we should be as invisible as possible.
Right. Excellent.
You know, sort of aid in the storytelling, but not so that it's noticed too much.
And
it tends to be mainly letterers that scrutinise other letterers.
Is it a fairly cutthroat world? I mean, you mentioned about a scalpel. You know, you all do come heavily armed.
I don't kind of listen to all the cutthroat stuff, I'm afraid. I just get on with it.
And do you have much contact with artists, you know, or is it just when there's an issue?
I think it is so much better if you do have communication with the artist and possibly the writer too sometimes. You know, there have been occasions, not working with Rebellion, where I've been given an impossible script by a very wordy writer, and editors didn't want to touch him.
Mm.
You know, it's like every word was sacred. So I just phone up and say, look, I'm sorry, I can't fit this in. And they've said, oh, just cut it how you think, Annie. You know, they're not being precious about it. It tends to be editorial that daren't touch it. As I say, I'm not talking about Rebellion in this case.
So, you're the letterer on Judge Dredd. And have been for some time. Now that was a strip that the late great Tom Frame had made very much his own. Do you think that with a strip, such a long running strip like Judge Dredd, do you think it's important it has a kind of continuity of lettering? Because there's so many different art styles and lots of different writing styles, but really the one constant all the way through has been a handful of letterers. You know, yourself, Tom, I know Ellie's done some stuff as well. Do you think that's important?
No.
No?
No. I think, you know, we all deserve a turn. I'm not sure I'd like the idea that, you know, I am the Judge Dredd letterer.
Sure.
You know, I think swap things around a bit, be fine. I don't know that my lettering suits every artist, to be honest.
Okay, oh, that's interesting. Have there been times you've looked at art and gone, this isn't really going to fit?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. And strangely enough, I can't letter Steve Parkhouse's work.
Oh, really?
He does letter his own anyway. But whenever I letter his, and when I have to because of time, it's just never looked right somehow. Because his artwork is so distinctive that his lettering fits.
Mm.
So, yes, that's always been interesting.
Yeah. And as this has been something that has been a constant in your life, but something that you've fitted around other things, how do you feel sort of looking back on that fateful day when somebody said do some lettering and in your own words you got stuck doing it? How do you feel about that?
Grateful.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that I've always had a constant, whatever else has been going on in my life, the lettering and the comic book work has always been a constant, which I've enjoyed. Mm. Sometimes I've thought it has stopped me from doing other things. You know, when things have got tough and you just hold on that little bit too long.
Yeah.
Rather than jumping ship. And then, of course, the lettering comes back and you think, oh, great, you know, I'm back into my pool of light, my comfortable pool of light where I can work happily, listen to music, and, you know, and I sink back into it. So, yes, it stopped me being a bit more adventurous in other directions, probably. That's right. The only sort of negative thing I can think about. Also, when I say I was asked to do some lettering, it was really quite dramatic. It was like the moment the understudy has to go on stage, someone came in and said, the show must go on. It was a Friday and it's got to go off, you know, first thing on Monday. And I carved it out of concrete so it was ready for the Monday. But yeah, it was very, very stressful.
Are there any particular strips that stand out in your memory as being ones that either you've been proud to have worked on or that you are very proud of the way that you handled the lettering on that?
Oh, I don't think that's a very fair question. No, I don't, you know, I'm not a very proud person.
No, it's good. I mean, it ties in nicely to you know, the chat we had just a moment ago about how lettering should be the invisible element of it. You know, if you're noticing it too much, then
yes,
something,
you're not doing your job.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
exactly
right. Yeah,
but yeah, I mean just the names that we've mentioned over the course of this chat you know, they've helped make 2000 AD number one readable on a purely basic level, but also, you know, they do have you've all helped bring a great deal of consistency and readability to the comic. And I think, you know, without yourself, without Ellie, without Simon, who we're going to be chatting to in a little bit, without people like Tom and you know, Richard Starkings, people like that, you know, It wouldn't necessarily be the comic that it is, because the lettering is such an intrinsic part of that.
Yes, I think so. Yes, it's what makes a comic strip.
Fantastic. Well, Annie, I have run out of questions.
Okay. Well, a pleasure speaking to you.
And you. Thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks again to Annie for taking some time to talk to us about the hidden art of lettering. We've got Simon Boland, who's another one of our letterers, coming up in a bit. But before then, we have our now regular feature, Ask Tharg, where we invite the Mighty One himself to come down into the sub-basement to answer your questions that you sent in. If you'd like to ask Tharg the Mighty himself a question, then please do drop a line to thrillcast@2000adonline.com. That's thrillcast@2000adonline.com. No question is off limits, though, of course, Rogelian hotshots might be sent out to the impertinent and the cheeky. Now, I just want to check with everybody here that we have all the shielding in place that we need. Yeah, okay, that's good, because, of course, last time we had a real problem with the sheer thrill power emanating from the Mighty One blowing all our circuits. We've only just really tidied up. So, without much further ado, I would like to welcome Tharg the Mighty back to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Salutations, Mighty One.
Greetings, Molchar. I see again you have interrupted my day to bring me more questions. from Squawkstick Thargo. I hope, for your sake, that this is worth it.
Absolutely, Mighty One, and I apologise for disturbing you in your great work. Earthlit Steve Harris has sent in a question, which was, when was the first time that the term Squawkstick Thargo was ever used?
The first time the Betelgeusean term Squawkstick Thargo, or Friends of Tharg, was ever used, Earthlit, was when I was a mere sproglet growing up on Quacksand. I gathered together other like-minded beings who dreamt of spreading the gift of thrill power and revolutionizing the graphic entertainment, and these became my squawks. I freely and obviously humbly admit to being an insufferably pompous young alien who talked about himself in the third person. Later, it became a reference to the loyal readers of the galaxy's greatest comic, who were equally upon the same wavelength of greatness.
That's super, Mighty One. Thank you very much. And it's well done, everybody, for keeping the shielding in place. I didn't fancy going deaf again. So the next question is from Earthlit Matthew Reese, and he says, what is your digital strategy with 2018, Mighty One?
Our digital strategy is to continue to develop our hugely successful mobile apps, which allow you to download your purchases on any device, DRM-free. Any further development of the apps will hinge on whether MechQuake has eaten another programmer droid again.
Yeah, that was really horrible. You could hear the screams for days. Thank you, Mighty One. The third and final question, your mightiness, is from Earthlit Richard Anderson, who says, with the recent return of John Smith to the prog, is there any chance we'll see any more Devlin War in the near future?
I would very much love to have Devlin War back in the comic of tomorrow, Earthlit, but alas, he remains resting for now, while the Smith droid conjures up new adventures. Expect to see the script bot teaming up again with Lee Carter on Indigo Prime in 2016.
And with that, the Mighty One has left the sub-basement. Thank you very much indeed to His Mightiness for taking the time to answer Earthlit's questions. I am all in one piece, as is everybody else, though the containment field is going to take some bolstering, I fear. Like I said, if you've got questions for the Mighty One, then please do send them to thrillcast@2000adonline.com. Now, having talked to one of our longest-standing lettering droids, it's now time to talk to one of our relatively newest droids, and Simon Boland is on the line. Welcome to the Thrillcast, Simon.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So, how long have you been with the Galaxy's Greatest now?
I think it's about 7 years now.
7 years. Wow. Okay. Is it mostly 2000 AD stuff that you do, or are you able to mix it up with other publications, other companies?
No, I'm really only on 2000 AD one day a week.
Okay.
Lets me go for the rest of the week, and I'm generally working for the American market for the rest of the time.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how you got into lettering, because it seems like a relatively odd thing to want to do as a career.
Yes, I don't think there's a long list of people asking to do that when they're in front of the careers advisor. Basically, I was working as a graphic designer for a number of years.
Mm.
So I already knew how to use all the software that I would need to do comic book lettering.
Mm.
And it just got to the point where I was a bit bored doing the graphic design work. I was a bit fed up going into the design studio every day. I wanted to work for myself, and I'd read comics since about the age of 8. I'd always had a fascination with the lettering side of it.
Mm.
And just one day thought, I'm going to jack my job in and see if I can make it full-time as a letterer.
Wow.
Which was quite scary, but ultimately I got there in the end.
Yeah, brilliant. So for someone who's a complete novice when it comes to this kind of stuff, as a letterer, are you chosen to work on particular strips by the publisher, or do you pitch, or do you work with particular writers and artists?
It's all of those, really.
Okay.
You can be chosen by the publisher, the editor. They can just offer you gigs out of the blue. Particularly with creator-owned stuff now, with Image, you have to go chasing that.
Mm.
Because it's usually decided by the writer and the artist, so you need to have some kind of relationship with them to get offered the work.
Yeah.
So you have to learn how to market yourself. You've got to make sure that you run your lettering career as a proper business.
Mm.
Take it really seriously and never get comfortable. You should always be chasing the next gig and knocking on doors, really.
Sure. I mean, no different to the writers and artists that you work with, I guess.
No, unless you're on a contract. The guys at Marvel, the letterers at Marvel are on a contract, but unless you're lucky enough to have that, you've just got to constantly keep looking for the next assignment, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you said at the beginning, that there aren't many people who'd say they want to be a letterer when they're talking to the school careers officer. But is it a fairly cutthroat business? Are there a lot of letterers out there?
Yeah, there's more letterers than there is work available.
Mm.
So it's become quite cutthroat. In recent years, people are trying to undercut other people with page rates and things like that. And lettering is always the first to get squeezed when a book is trying to reduce its budget down.
Mm. Okay. And I presume, based on what you've already said, that you've always been digital. You've never had because we were just talking to Annie about how she lettered for most of her career was physically doing it on the page, as it were. I presume you've always been a digital letterer.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I used to work on a couple of fanzines when I was younger, and I did some lettering for them by hand, using pen and ink. But it's, for me, professionally, it's always been digital. Yeah, that's the way everybody wants it now.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to be working on 2000 AD?
I just wrote to Matt one day, sent him a letter with a printout of some samples, and got the polite, "We'll keep your details on file" letter back.
Sure.
And I just thought, well, I'll never hear from them again. That's one of those filed under B for bin.
Mm.
But then a couple of months later, just had an email from Matt out of the blue asking me if I could do a quick lettering job on a Judge Dredd strip.
Mm.
And was absolutely delighted and got that turned around for him. And it just snowballed from there, really.
Right. I presume that was probably one of the... was it the quickest turnaround you've ever done, or was it the most meticulous turnaround you've ever done?
Both.
Quick and good, wow.
Very, very quickly.
Right.
I don't think I slept much that night. It had to be done quickly, but obviously I desperately wanted to impress Matt.
Yeah.
And because I'd grown up reading 2000 AD from a very early age as well, it was a huge deal for me. So I wanted to make sure it was as perfect as I could possibly make it. But at the same time, I had to show Matt that I could turn work around quickly if I needed to.
Sure. Leaving aside the kind of, trying to impress moments where you didn't get much sleep, how many pages a day, for example, are you able to letter?
It's about 20.
Okay.
I mean, before now, I've done as much as 40 in a day.
Wow.
But that's, you're talking an 18-hour day to do that. Ideally, you're expected to turn a full American-sized comic around in a day, which is 22 pages.
Mm.
So you need to learn to be quick, because on top of that, you've obviously got to handle corrections, deal with incoming emails and all that kind of thing.
Okay, okay. So it was interesting what you were saying about having been a graphic designer, because Annie, for example, started off in the design team, well, the kind of editorial production team, you know, cutting and pasting and doing stuff. She wasn't a letterer, but then got into it. Is there something about the connection between graphic designers and lettering that makes them ideal?
Yeah, I think so. I think you need to have an eye for design to make sure that the lettering flows nicely across the page. It needs to be almost invisible, really. You need to just be reading it without realizing that you're reading it, if that makes sense. So whereas an artist can try to be quite flashy with his work, we have to be very subtle, very much in the background. And I think an experience from the design industry does help with that. But also for myself, when I was working as a graphic designer, I also learned about print and production. And I think a knowledge of that is really beneficial to letterers, because it helps you understand what you can and can't do with your work.
In terms of what you do, is the art of lettering more than just bubbles? Is it sound effects? If so, you know, is that an opportunity for a little bit more kind of out there creativity?
Yeah, sound effects are the part where we can really cut loose.
Right.
But again, we have to be make sure that we don't make it all about the lettering. Even with a dynamic sound effect, it still needs to complement the artwork. It still needs to not cover too much. It needs to blend in quite nicely. But yeah, it is a chance for us to be a bit more creative than just the basic dialogue balloons.
Sure, sure. Are there different demands from working on something like 2000 AD and working on American comic book? Are there different demands as to how you actually do the lettering on the page? Are there different kind of house styles at all, or is it very much your judgment on how you do things?
No, it's very much my judgment. I've been really lucky that the editors that I've worked with have always trusted me to do my own thing. I've never really been directed to follow certain styles or anything like that.
Sure.
So it's all about, I mean, a letter has a lot of fonts available to them nowadays. And you can either constantly use different ones for different assignments, or you can stick to the same one so that your work is a bit more recognisable. But it gives you the opportunity, to try out different styles. And as I say, I've always been lucky to have editors who have basically just said, we trust you and do what you do best.
Yeah. That was one thing I was going to ask you about was font. Because you say, you know, the world is your oyster now as to what font you use. But you look at like somebody like Tom Frame or Steve Potter, they had very, very distinctive ways of lettering. So they were, you know, particularly Tom's was unmistakable on the page.
Definitely.
Is there a particular font that you favour, or maybe one that you've created yourself that you would like to be recognisable as your work?
Yeah, I'm looking to roll out my own personal font next year.
Oh wow! Okay,
and that will be one that can't be bought by anybody else. So it will basically, when you see that font, it will be my work.
Okay.
And I think you need, if you want to establish yourself as a letterer, I think you need that, because it's too easy for somebody to just buy the same font that you're using, and then to the untrained eye, you know, your work starts to blend into their work. Like you say, guys like Tom Frame, I mean, his work was, you could look at a page and immediately know, without looking at the credits, that it was his work.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go down that road myself. I'd like to be a bit more identifiable by the fonts that I'm using. So yeah, that's something that I'm looking to start using next year, hopefully.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. What makes a good font from a comic book lettering point of view?
I personally think a nice clear one is best. There's a lot of fonts out there that can be quite jazzy, quite stylish, and there's a lot of design work gone into them, but for me, I prefer the clean and clear kind of style. Again, you know, if you look at Tom Frame's work, there was no fancy characters in there. It was very clear.
Yeah.
Very easy to read at any kind of size, but it worked superbly well.
Is there a time when a script has called for an unusual font or an unusual approach, and you've not been 100%, you know, this is the right thing, or have you made the best of the situation?
I think I've moaned at the editor. I used to get that quite a bit when I was working at Marvel. They used to have quite an interest in using lots of different fonts for different characters to give them a different style of speech.
Yeah.
But I used to try and discourage that because I personally thought that made the page look a bit messy, and it was calling too much attention to the lettering.
Sure.
And making it more than it should be.
Mm.
So I would quite often just suggest that it would look better if we just stuck to the regular dialogue font. And a lot of the time, I would get the green light with that. But sometimes I was told, no, you know, Iron Man has to have robotic font, and that's the end of that. But on 2000 AD, we don't really go beyond ghostly balloons for spooky characters, where we'll just generally make the balloon a bit wobbly and generally put the text as white on black as opposed to black on white. And I do think it looks better when you've just got one main font throughout the book.
Hmm.
I think it makes it look nicer.
Sure, sure. How do you learn as a letterer? Because obviously there's plenty of guides on how to draw and write comic books. But do letterers talk amongst themselves? Are there resources that you can go to you know, brush up on skills, or is it a case that you learn on the job?
I'm mostly self-taught, really.
Mm.
It's a case of studying other people's work when I was starting out, and then figuring out how I make software do similar things. But I used to ask Richard Starkings, who's a very well-known letterer.
Mm.
I used to ask him for advice, and sometimes I'd send him my work and he'd critique it. So that was a huge help. But mostly, I think we're all self-taught. There's no real courses that you could do for that. Which again is where the whole career in design comes in handy, because you've already learned the software.
Yeah.
So it's just a case of learning how to apply that to the actual art of lettering.
Mm.
And I think you just have to use your brain power for that and just figure things out.
Sure, sure. One thing Annie mentioned was about balloon placement and that golden rule about the top third of the panel needing to be free for lettering. Has there ever been a time that you've got some artwork through and you've gone, oh God, what am I going to do with this?
Most weeks. The problem is now, because lettering is no longer on the actual artwork.
Yeah,
I think it's harder for an artist to remember that they need to leave the room for the lettering.
Okay.
Because in the past, they would turn in the pencils and the lettering would be done on the pencils.
Mm.
And then the artwork would be inked. Whereas now, it's just very much, it's become separated a bit more. And it is difficult, I think, sometimes for an artist to remember it's all right to leave all this empty space. I think they feel the need to do a full job and make every panel as good as he possibly can.
Mm.
And the problem is that sometimes I do think some artists forget that there's got to be dialogue added to that. And then it's just a case of, as a letterer, you have to make sure you cover up the absolute minimum amount of that artwork, even if you've been left no room. It's kind of a case of tough. You've just got to find a way to make that work.
Sure.
And to be honest, I sometimes get quite a sense of achievement when I've looked at a panel and thought, that's impossible.
Mm.
And then actually made it work. It's obviously, it will have taken me a lot longer.
Sure.
But I can look back at that and think, well, you know what? I've done a decent job on that.
Because I imagine there's a lot of people who look at comic book lettering and think, well, I've got Photoshop or I've got InDesign or whatever. That looks dead easy. Why is what letterers do so important when computer fonts have become so much more versatile than they used to be?
I think we need to make sure that when a person's reading a comic book, they can lose themselves in that comic book and get immersed in the whole experience of it. And I think the second you start to wonder, well, which balloon am I supposed to read next?
Yeah.
You've lost that experience. You've come out of that world and you're back in the real world and you're trying to figure out which order to read the dialogue in. Mm. And I think it's really important to make sure that the reader doesn't ever experience that. And that's why placement is so important, as well as not covering up important parts of the artwork. You also need to make sure that a person can just switch off and read the comic for 20 minutes or however long and just lose themselves in the experience. And that can sometimes be the difference between a decent letterer and someone who's not quite got the hang of it.
I mean, that's what it comes back to all the way through our chat with Annie and what I've said in the intro, which is this is really the invisible art of comic books, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, if anybody wants to become mildly famous, then they need to learn to draw comics, I think, or write them, because I've never been to a comic convention and had someone come up and say, you know, can you sign this comic? You're very much anonymous a lot of the time. But you go into it knowing that. It's not as if it's sprung on you. You should be well aware of that and should have no problems with accepting that. It is very much an unsung art, but it's still an important one.
Sure.
At the end of the day.
Sure. Like artists refining their work as their careers progress, are you always tinkering with the way that you do balloons and tails and fonts?
Yeah, I'm still teaching myself new tricks even today. I mean, I've been doing it probably 12 or 13 years now.
Mm.
And it's only really the last 18 months that I've stopped cringing at my work when I see it, but even now I'm still not happy with it. I'm still constantly looking at things that I can tweak and refine, and I think you should always be looking at that. Even when you've been doing a job for 30 odd years, I think you should still constantly challenge yourself to be better, as opposed to just resting on your laurels.
Are there particular artists that you enjoy working with?
The ones that leave me room. I love them. it is the ones that leave me room.
Right.
It's sometimes you can see that an artist has really poured everything that they've got into a comic book. And I love working on those. It motivates me, knowing that they've done absolutely everything that they could. It motivates me to do my absolute best job. And it's the same with writers. When you read a script that blows your mind, you just think, I'm going to give them my absolute best, because they've given their absolute best.
Sure.
And it's really, I'm happy to work with artists of any styles. I don't really have a preference for that. It's just, I just like to see that somebody's put their passion and the heart and soul into a page, and it motivates the rest of the team, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, Simon, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for chatting to us about the invisible art of lettering at 2000 AD.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
No worries. It's been another stellar
episode of the 2080 Thrillcast. I want to thank Annie and Simon and also Tharg the Mighty himself for coming on and talking about their work. Next time on the 2080 Thrillcast, we're going to have something a little special for you for Christmas. Please do check out all the great tomes that are available from 2080. They make excellent Christmas presents. I can in particular recommend the recent Dan Dare and Mech Files and Robusters hardbacks if you have a 2080 fan in your life, or if you fancy like treating yourself for Christmas. So until the day before Christmas, Splunder Dig Verthrig Earthlets. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2080 is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2080 is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2080online.com, or you can download the free 2080 app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2080 classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter where we are at 2000AD. Remember, Earthlets, don't be a Grexnix, Splundig Verthrig!